On ABC Radio Canberra, this is Dan Borsha.
Language is so important. It gives us a sense of who we are, of our connection to the world around us, an understanding of our story and our identity, but also a bit about where we're going. And it's how we communicate, how we are able to grapple with so many big concepts. And so many Indigenous First Nations languages in Australia have been lost over time as a result of all the policies that we've spoken about a lot here on ABC Radio Canberra. So how do you revive a language that was taken away, that has been lost? How do you find those words that haven't been spoken in years? And the term, and I love this, how do you wake up a sleeping language? Dorga is one of the languages of the Yuin Nation, spoken on the New South Wales South Coast and the Southern Tamberlands, from south of Nowra to Naruma, west of Braidwood and Araluen as well. There are three siblings, Patricia Ellis, Karen Boyenga, and Wayne Donovan. They've spent the last two decades teaching, reviving the Dorga language in schools, and they've recently published a Dorga dictionary and learner's grammar, and they've worked alongside linguists as well as their local community on recovering those terms, finding the stories and reconnecting them. Patricia Ellis is one of those siblings and is with us. Yuma, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Wonderful to have you along. How important is your language to you?
Oh, it's really hard to put that in a sentence. It's a language that my mother spoke, my grandmother spoke, all the old people spoke. When I was growing up, I'd hear people speaking in language and not have a clue, and it sounded like they were singing. But due to different policies over the years, it became impossible for local communities to speak our language and keep the language alive, because we only had snippets of the language. We have had words, I think, and that was all we had. So, but, you know, like most kids, we thought those words were made, words that were made up or, you know, not real language. But then when we studied our language and looked at what had been recorded, we realised that the words that we knew were valid.
And is that, was that the starting point, those words that you knew that had become perhaps common vernacular, was that the starting point of recovering, reawakening this sleeping language?
The starting point was probably Browley Public School had a German teacher and she resigned, and my sister Kerry Boyenga was teaching there at the time, and she suggested to the really supportive principal that they had at the time that instead of employing another German teacher, why don't we teach a local Aboriginal language? The suggestion was, okay, pick a language that everybody, that a lot of people speak, but my sister was pretty adamant that we should be learning our own language. So she was given the task to approach the Education Department, the Board of Studies and linguists, and actually get some funding to help to get people to track down what was actually left of our language. Yeah. And that's where it started.
And to give us a sense of the work over the last two decades.
Yeah, very. My brother Wayne taught at the school as well. Once they got funding from the Board of Studies, the Education Department, they were able to involve several linguists along the way who had records and knowledge of our language, and they were able to compile a list of our words. And even around like 2010, 2011, we only had about 300 words, which is not really quite enough to recover your language. But fortunately for us, a German woman named Jutta Besselt did a thesis at the Australian National University on all five languages of the South Coast, or all four languages. One of them was actually a dialect. And once she actually got employed to come and work with us as well and to get more language from the community or to verify what they already had. And in doing that, Yuta's thesis, which was available to everybody in like 2013, I actually then went in and plucked all of the Dorga words out of that and 730 words later, we have our dictionary.
That's amazing. So it really came from collaboration and support at a whole range of different levels.
Absolutely. There was a lot of community consultation. Kerry and Wayne went to the World Indigenous Peoples Conference and they presented there. They talked with people out around. They met with people in Dubbo and other places that were recovering their language. They talked with people from New Zealand. They talked with every Aboriginal community pretty much from, I guess, Wallaga Lake up to Wollongong. And the Browley Public School formed a partnership with Incentia High School and then formed a partnership with Kabarra Land Council, Maruya Local Aboriginal Land Council, then formed a partnership again with the New South Wales TAFE. And all of the people who were involved in all those different services were really supportive of the project, and that's how it grew.
How do you feel now when you hear people speaking Dorrigo?
Oh, I actually cried the first time I heard a group of school kids sing We Are Australian in Dorrigo. And this year, actually, no, not this year, last year, was the first time ever that we know of that an Aboriginal person, well, I was invited to at the Anzac Parade to do the ode in Dorrigo.
What was that like?
That was pretty empowering, pretty amazing. And there were so many Aboriginal people that you could just see the pride. You know, we had Aboriginal people in the services as well, and it honoured them as well.
Yeah, and as I've spoken about here before, those service people came back and from the Second World War and weren't Australian citizens.
Yes, that's right. We don't have a very nice history, but, you know, we're trying to change that.
Do you feel like it is changing?
Slowly.
Yeah.
Slowly, ever so slowly.
Annie, you spoke about there that the ode. Do you remember how to present the ode in Dorrigo?
Not without actually looking at it, but I can say we are Australian. Nayawanya. Hang on, give me a second.
As you're doing that, I'll just remind people that we're talking to Patricia Ellis, Annie Tricia of the Dorrigo people, who's recognised last year as an Elder of the Year at the NAIDOC Awards. I believe when they were here in Canberra, in fact, and has done tremendous amount of work as a teacher and co-author to recover, to reawaken, to protect and preserve the Dorrigo language.
I can give you a couple of sentences of We Are Australian.
I'd love that.
Middendal Nayawanya, Dawamalanya Nayawanya, Bananda Dawamalanya Yanane. So just basically, we are one, but we are many. And from all the lands on earth we come. So I remember that better than the ode, just because I did it more often.
I love that you picked that bit of the song, which is about inclusiveness and coming together and all being essentially one. There's a beautiful poignance to that, isn't there?
Absolutely, and we often use the words out of that song, which incidentally was written by someone out of the Seekers in like 1985, and I'm surprised that song wasn't much popular a lot sooner. It's got a lot more popularity these days because a lot of people are trying to be a lot more inclusive, and that's why we chose that song to translate.
I know that it's controversial, but it often comes up, doesn't it, that could be a possible Australian national anthem if there was ever a move on to change.
It certainly makes sense to do something that's inclusive.
Now that you've done all that work on the Dorrigo dictionary and recovering and reawakening that language, is there a what next about where you take this, about how you continue perhaps to share the language from here?
There's all this talk of strategic plans and where to from here, but, you know, the path presents itself. And if you're awake to that or you're open to that, it will show you what direction to go next. We're really surprised at the popularity of the dictionary. Of course, we are so proud and, of course, we think it's a wonderful thing, And so many people have just embraced it, and now all schools all around, all over the coast that are in Dooraga speaking country are starting language programs, and that means that they will have to get more Aboriginal people in to teach the language, and that's always a good thing.
What does it say to you that it's been that popular and has been picked up across the board?
It says to me that Aboriginal people in particular are very hungry for anything to do with culture and with our language. It belongs to everyone. It's our pride. Language and culture go hand in hand. It says to me that a lot of non-Aboriginal people are ready to embrace it as well and support whatever Aboriginal communities are doing with language.
Mm. And just on that point, I know that we've been doing a lot of work here on ABC Radio and across the ABC around bringing language to the fore, and you'll hear it as part of our programming and welcoming on some of our presenters throughout the day. And the question I always get asked is it okay if you're non-Indigenous to use language to be speaking in someone else's language? What do you say to that?
If only Aboriginal people speak language, it won't come back to life. Language needs to be spoken to be vibrant.
Is there something about language being perhaps the bridge that connects us?
I believe so. I believe that language does connect people. When you learn an Aboriginal language, and I get that some people are a little bit reluctant to have non-Aboriginal people speaking our language, I get that, and I get the reasons why. And mostly it's about people using mispronunciation or it's about people not understanding the full concept of what the words mean. Because in our language, there are words that don't have an English interpretation, and it's really hard to explain what the real meaning of the word is sometimes. So if people want to speak our language, they need to learn about our culture as well, and that's not a bad thing.
So perhaps it goes hand in hand. Have the conversations about the culture and then follow that up with the use of language.
Absolutely.
Look, so wonderful to chat with you this afternoon. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
There's Annie Tricia Ellis there, a Dooraga speaker, and has done a tremendous amount of work on recovering the language, working on the dictionary.
Dan Borsha on ABC Radio Canberra.
I'm not sure if you've been watching on ABC Canberra News, but we've had over the last couple of months some stories about some of the great work that's been happening in Canberra schools around language as well. Another Kathy, different Kathy, says, "G'day Dan, a sleeping language. I have to confess this will be really hard for me. I have problems with restaurant menus in French, but so true, as you guess Patricia says, about learning from the local people. Kids will just fly through. For oldies like me," says Kathy, "it's going to be repetition and forget any embarrassment. In terms like the use of country and culture is gradually sinking in, so we'll get there together." And this is the thing, isn't it? Is that we're all walking along this path, and it's so important that we are all included as part of those conversations. And I'm sure that's a point that Dr. Charlene Robinson is going to want to jump in on as well, the Senior Curator of Oral History and Indigenous Programs at the National Library of Australia, who's here now. Yuma, good afternoon.
Hello, it's lovely to be talking with you, Dan.
Great to have you back. We are going to talk about what I asked you on about speeches in a moment, but I'm not sure if you heard much of that conversation about the Dooraga Dictionary just before, but that comes very much into your work, doesn't it, around capturing Indigenous stories and language and preserving it.
Absolutely. I think that's a very strong priority of the library as a whole. So, just a really pleasing time for me to sort of tune in and to hear about this.
Yeah, and the point I think that Tricia Ellis was making there is that we've seen such great, tremendous willingness and engagement from across the community that it feels like we're at that point of real change.
Absolutely. I think there is such enthusiasm and eagerness, amongst the broader community to learn about this ancient continuing culture that we are so fortunate in Australia to have people that can share that with us.
So yeah.
truly inspiring.
Yeah, it is. I can't help but smile and feel excited whenever I'm talking about language that's being preserved and maintained. And that's exactly what you're doing on the other part of your job when it comes to speeches that have been famous, some that have been infamous, that have cut through the politics of the day. I think we're going to start on former Prime Minister Menzies. We might have a little bit of a listen to some of what the speech that we heard a little earlier.
Fellow Australians, it is my melancholy duty to inform you officially that in consequence of a persistence by Germany in her invasion of Poland, Great Britain has declared war upon her, and that as a result, Australia is also at war. No harder task can fall to the lot of a democratic leader than to make such an announcement. Great Britain and France, with the cooperation of the British Dominions, have struggled to avoid this tragedy.
And we heard from Ian, a history buff, a little earlier about the nuance in that speech about Australia never actually declaring war.
There's so many details and there's so much that's interesting about that speech in that particular moment. I think the point that really I find quite striking, well, there's a couple of things. Firstly, how Menzies himself speaks. You know, he really has this very British way of speaking, which I think as we listen to that today, it sounds all very foreign to us almost, that that was how an Australian Prime Minister spoke. And the second point that I took from that really is just how automatic that statement was in his mind that, you know, Great Britain is at war, therefore we are also at war. And also his use of the word melancholy as he speaks, I think, is quite striking. You know, I think that it's a very grave thing as a Prime Minister to take a nation into war, a very serious duty. And Menzies was doing this in the aftermath of the First World War, which obviously had a devastating impact on Australia, with 60,000 people, more than 60,000 people dying, with a population of under 5 million. So to tell the Australian people in 1939, in the aftermath of World War One, that we're about to embark on another war, I think that would have been a really difficult speech to have to deliver.
And how much, when you talk about the use of melancholy there, how much was there real nuance in the rest of the language in that speech in particular?
Well, I think that, you know, he actually does kind of go on to sort of say that he acknowledges that it's one of the most sort of solemn things that a Prime Minister can do, probably one of the gravest act that you can do. And I think very mindful of the fact that by taking Australia into that conflict, it was inevitable that people would die. And of course, you know, around 27,000 Australians did die. So I think that it was, when you hear him speak, you can hear the seriousness, and that I think he really was quite melancholy as he delivered those lines.
Mm. We're going to go on to another Prime Minister now. Here's a little of John Curtin's speech. This was to Australia after Japan declared war, and this is from the beginning, the opening there of this speech.
Men and women of Australia, we are at war with Japan. That has happened because in the first instance, Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack on British and United States territory. Because our vital interests are imperiled, and because the rights of free people in the whole Pacific are assailed. As a result, the Australian government this afternoon took the necessary steps which will mean that a state of war exists between Australia and Japan. Tomorrow, in common with the United Kingdom, the United States of America, and the Netherlands East Indies governments, the Australian government will formally and solemnly declare the state of war it has striven so sincerely and strenuously to avoid.
Yeah, and another strong speech there, isn't it, Dr. Shalene Robinson?
Yes, and I mean, don't you find there's sort of difference in the way that they speak quite interesting, that, you know, he's got quite a broad, I guess what we consider a broad Australian accent in how he delivers those lines. And I think Curtin is really interesting as a speaker and as somebody who wrote speeches because, you know, Robert Menzies was quite formally educated, but in contrast to that, John Curtin left school, I think, when he was aged around 13. So, you know, very much a self-educated man, and I think somebody who took on the duty of serving as wartime Prime Minister, and it took a terrible toll on him. He was somebody who really felt the responsibility of being a wartime leader very, very keenly, and I think that as he spoke, like Menzies, I think he was fully aware that he was telling the Australian people that the war had taken a very grave turn. And although he doesn't say it, I think what he's trying to prepare people for is the fact that the war is much more in our geographical region at that point, and that invasion is a very real possibility.
And even pointing there to, at the end, saying, you know, in the days ahead, we're going to be declaring the state of war, and but then going to pains to say this is something that we've really worked to try and avoid. You can hear the weight in that, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. And I think he really asks the Australian people. I mean, there's some great lines as he continues, because he asks the Australian people for their courage, physical and mental ability, and inflexible determination. So he really knows that it's going to be a much harder task that lies ahead for the country. So it's a really, really wonderful speech, but also a really that real sense of that moment in time and what that must have felt like for people hearing that.
I mean, that's one of the real powers of speeches, isn't it? Is that they capture a moment in time and a bit of a kaleidoscope of everything that was going on in that moment.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as we listen to the voice of Robert Menzies or the voice of John Curtin, we could look up those speeches and we could sort of read the text. But there is something very special, I think, about hearing the way they pause and the way that they emphasise particular words, the way that they have different accents and so on. But, yeah, there is something very powerful about speeches that are delivered in this kind of context.
And the next one we're going to listen to was Neville Bonner, who, of course, was the first Aboriginal person into Parliament in the Senate. And this is from an interview with Pat Shaw, and speaking with quite a bit of bluntness, I think, about the state of affairs in the lead-up to 1967.
Yes, the 1967 referendum, it was in a number of parts. The referendum was proposed to break the nexus between the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the other part of it was to allow the federal government the right to make special laws for Aborigines, and to allow, for the first time in our history, we, the Aboriginal people, to be counted in the census. Now, you know, prior to that, we had stock taking for cattle, horses, sheep, and all those sorts of things. But Aborigines were not non-entities within the broader Australian community. We were not even allowed to be counted in the census. We were not even allowed the vote. We were defranchised. We weren't even allowed to vote until after 1967. The referendum, the people of Australia rejected a part of that referendum which had to deal with the nexus. Rejected it outright. But it was the highest vote ever recorded in Australia to carry something that was proposed in a referendum where it referred to the Aboriginal people. The highest vote ever recorded. I forget the percentage, but well over the 80% of the Australian people gave notice to the Australian government that they believed that the Aboriginal people should be counted in the census, and that the federal government should take responsibility for the advancement of the Indigenous people of this country, both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders.
And that was Neville Bonner there being interviewed by Pat Shaw and Dr. Shalene Robinson. I was discussing this with Adam Shirley a little earlier about where the big change, as was captured there, is driven by politicians who enact the change, or whether it's actually the people, as you heard, the overwhelming result of the 1967 referendum.
Oh, look, I think that's a really great point to make. And I think that, you know, you never want to forget the extraordinary effort that was put into people who advocated for that change. Mm-hmm. And Neville Bonner and Oodgeroo Noonuckle, I think Oodgeroo Noonuckle travelled to every part of Australia to sort of draw attention to this. And, you know, these advocates, and there were so many advocates, played an extraordinary role in moving that change forward. And I think that, you know, I don't really want to give too much credit to politicians when I think that, that result depended on the hard work of a lot of First Nations people, but also, you know, Australians, as Neville Bonner really speaks so powerfully really sort of, I guess, giving notice, as he says, that that there needed to be greater responsibility taken. And I think that Neville Bonner is such a beautiful speaker, and what I really like about that speech is actually, you know, that's not a speech. That's, you can get a sense of how skilled he was, because that's just him in an interview scenario talking about something, and yet he's so able to bring that passion and that sense of emotion at a time into his conversation. So it really does give you a window into just what a brilliant man Neville Bonner was. Mm.
And being able to capture the bluntness, the blunt force of what the case was in Australia before 1967 in such an eloquent way, I think it always cuts through whenever I've listened to anything that Neville Bonner has spoken about. There's a real poignance there. The next speech we're going to have a listen to, this is from the National Press Club on the 2nd of March 1983 from Bob Hawke. Now, this is just before he became Prime Minister.
This is what this election is all about. Yesterday, Mr. Fraser correctly described it as a momentous election, but not for the reasons he gave. The outcome of this election will indeed determine what sort of a future Australians will make for themselves, not merely for the rest of the century, but into the next. There can be no underestimating the present crisis and the immediate problems we face. But in this age of rapid technological change, in a world, in a region caught up in one of the most profound and far-reaching industrial and technological revolutions in human history, we have to make decisions, both as a government and a nation, which will set the course far beyond the term of the next Parliament, and indeed beyond the end of this century. And I don't believe we will be able to make the right decisions unless we have a new national government determined to end the politics of division and confrontation, unless we have a new national government to set Australia on the course of national reconciliation, national recovery, and national reconstruction.
Yeah, an incredible communicator.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting to hear that, because it's just, I think, must have been about 3 days before the election was held that he gave that speech. And, you know, Bob Hawke, I think, was the most electorally successful of all the Labor Prime Ministers in terms of winning successive victories. And when you listen to that speech and, I guess, the fluency of it and the way that he's able to set out the particular vision or what he thinks is at stake, you really get that sense of how he was able to communicate with the Australian people, I guess, so successfully. And at that election, you know, a few days after he gave that speech, I think he won something like a 24-seat majority. So it was obviously a very successful one. I guess something I find quite interesting is, again, people really did talk and think of Bob Hawke as being, you know, the people's prime minister, and I think he was very good at that. But he was also an Oxford-educated man and very, very formally educated, but yet he was able to just reach out and really get his points across in that way.
Mm. And a way of coming across as a regular, everyday bloke. I think that was one of the things that most resonated, wasn't it, is that people felt a real connection there.
Yeah, and I think that gift of actually being able to bring people with you, it's such a wonderful thing to have in politics when you do have a leader who's sort of inspiring and can take people with them on the journey. And I think it's not incredibly common that politicians really can speak in a way that's perceived as genuine and bring people with them on that journey.
Mm. It's a skill I suspect most politicians would want an abundance more of. The next speech that we're going to look at is former Prime Minister Julia Gillard, and I played a little of this earlier that really resonated and had enormous cut through.
I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not. And the government will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. Not now, not ever. The Leader of the Opposition says that people who hold sexist views and who are misogynists are not appropriate for high office. Well, I hope the Leader of the Opposition has got a piece of paper and he is writing out his resignation. Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror.
Wow, it was tremendously strong and still is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And just listening back to that, you think, wow, that must have come as quite a surprise to Tony Abbott sitting across the parliament. And I think I do have a recollection of sort of his face as Gillard spoke. But, you know, what I think is really interesting is later we found out more about the context of her producing that speech. And I believe that she went into parliament just with a few of the statements that Abbott had made, and literally was scrawling notes as she was in parliament. So I think that just that sort of, it's almost an off-the-cuff speech, yet, you know, it's delivered with such fluency and it's very strong. And I think that it not only cut through in Australia, but it really is something that was reported all across the world. So it's possibly, I would say, one of Gillard's most well-known speeches, if not the most well-known of her speeches. But yet to think of it just sort of being put together in that really kind of almost hasty way is really quite an interesting element to it.
Yeah, I'm sure that I read somewhere at some point that it was, there were four or five dot points on a piece of paper, but you can hear the passion in the Prime Minister's voice, can't you?
I think that that's a really interesting point, because when we sort of think about what is it that makes a really great speech, what is it that connects with people, is it that passion is one of those elements? Because from the various bits and pieces that we've listened to today, you know, you had two very solemn speeches, but then we've had others that really, I think, had that level of emotion and are really sort of talking deeply to a very strongly felt issue. And, of course, the sexism that Julia Gillard experienced, I think it was something that she didn't speak about too often, and I think that this, you kind of really hear, it's a turning point in a way. It's the first time she really addresses a lot of the commentary and the issues and difficulties that she'd experienced head on, and you know, it just really all comes to the fore. And I think, yeah, that passion makes it really fascinating to listen to.
Yeah, and there was a quote in The Guardian from the former Prime Minister about that, and she spoke about how it really took on a life of its own. But this is the quote about what led to that point, at least in part in the Prime Minister's mind. After every sexist thing directed at me that I'd bitten my lip on, now I was going to be accused of sexism, the unfairness of that anger propelled me.
And isn't that even that, the words that she uses there about anger propelling her? And I think, yes, it's that she brings that into the speech and then she delivers it so strongly. And I think that even people who were on her side didn't really know that she was going to do that, or certainly not that strongly. Because if you think back to what the other faces sort of looked like around her, I think that they were, you know, her fellow party people were a bit, you know, that was good, but I don't think they saw it coming. So a really wonderful, wonderfully interesting moment in Australian political history.
Yeah, and one that we've now heard former Prime Minister Julia Gillard speak about it a number of times, write about in her book and the like. And you're right, I was just looking at some photos of those sitting around her, and you can see kind of faces looking, just staring on, like almost edging towards the end of their seats. You know, it was just one of those moments. It's been so great to chat with you this afternoon about some of the great speeches. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for the time, Dan. And, you know, if anyone's interested, I think there's about 54,000 hours in the National Library's collection.
Well, just on that, just before I let you go, where can you access that and how do you go about it?
Probably the easiest way is to go to nla.gov.au, have a look at the catalogue, and you can actually limit what you're looking for to audio, which will just bring up a lot of great material. So, you know, I think that there's so much that people can explore that I really do believe that amongst that 54,000 hours, there'll be something for everyone. And I'd be fascinated to hear of other people's favourites.
Always a pleasure to chat with you. Many thanks.
Thank you very much, Dan.